"Don't go to the theatre tonight, Dorian," said Hallward. "Stop and dine with me." "I can't, Basil." "Why?" "Because I have promised Lord Henry Wotton to go with him." "He won't like you the better for keeping your promises. He always breaks his own. I beg you not to go." Dorian Gray laughed and shook his head. "I entreat you." The lad hesitated and looked over at Lord Henry, who was watching them from the tea table with an amused smile. "I must go, Basil," he answered. "Very well," said Hallward, and he went over and laid down his cup on the tray. "It is rather late, and as you have to dress, you'd better lose no time. Goodbye, Harry." "Goodbye, Dorian. Come and see me soon. Come tomorrow." "Certainly." "You won't forget?" "No, of course not," cried Dorian. "And Harry?"
"Yes, Basil."
"Remember what I asked you when we were in the garden this morning?"
"I have forgotten it."
"I trust you."
"I wish I could trust myself," said Lord Henry, laughing. "Come, Mr. Grey. My hansom is outside, and I can drop you at your own place. Goodbye, Basil. It has been a most interesting afternoon."
As the door closed behind them, the painter flung himself down on a sofa, and a look of pain came into his face.
HPPodcraft.com.
That is the end of the second chapter of The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. And we're covering it here on the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We're here at HPPodcraft.com and Patreon. And we are joined once again by writer Jamie Britton, whom we last left smoking innumerable cigarettes on his fainting couch. Good evening, Jamie.
Good evening. Each one more exquisite and less satisfactory than the last one.
We are also joined once again by Greg Johnson as our reader.
Oh, he is such a delight. Yes. I love that guy. I love his reading. And I love his comedy. Go check it out. Greg Johnson on YouTube. He's got tons of awesome videos. He's hilarious. You'll love it.
We'll link out in the show notes. Greg is a wonderful actor, a very accomplished prop maker, which are fancy words for being a liar and forger, essentially. That's what he's good at. But that's the kind of scandalous company we like to keep in our little online salon here at the podcast.
So true. We didn't get very far into the story with our last episode here. All that happened was that the artist Basil Hallward has been painting a portrait of Dorian Gray, a young and inexperienced man. Dorian made a wish that the painting would get old and he would not, a wish that will quickly become a reality. Basil is friends with Lord Henry Wotton, a rich guy who loves being a cynical corrupter, and, as we heard in that reading, just got his seductive claws into Dorian Gray.
Yeah, it's that moment where your new friend meets your much cooler friend. You know, well, that was fun while it lasted.
Oh, man. Or if you're kind of dating a girl, you met a girl and you like her, and then she meets like your more handsome, cooler friend, and you just like go, nah, it's not happening anymore.
Yeah, whoops.
If it ever was.
I wish I knew what you guys were talking about, but I have no experience of any of those things.
That's because you were the cooler, seductive friend.
Oh, man. Yeah. Thanks, Jamie.
I was so cool and seductive, I can't even.
The next day, Lord Henry goes to visit his Uncle George to get the lowdown on Dorian, and he tells him that Dorian is the grandson of Lord Kelso, whose daughter, Lady Margaret Devereux, was very beautiful. She married someone below her social rank, and it's rumored that Lord Kelso had him killed in a duel. He also thinks that Dorian has a sizable inheritance coming his way.
The mother died within a year of the duel, so she was born out of this love affair that culminated in sadness. This whole book is in the tradition of the capital G gothic novel, but I did appreciate that we never had to settle old scores. You know, when this is set up, I thought, oh, I wonder if we're going to learn the identity of his true father or something like that. And it never goes into those places, thankfully. No.
Lord Henry then goes to his Aunt Agatha's house for lunch. There are others at this lunch, a bunch of society people, and Dorian is there. They complain about how American women are in fashion to marry. And I like this quote here. It says, "That is one of the greatest secrets of life. Nowadays, most people die of a sort of creeping common sense and discover when it's too late that the only things one never regrets are one's mistakes."
I mean, with any endeavor, rejection hurts, but not knowing is worse, right?
I find that the things in my life that I think about in the past are regrets of things I didn't do and not necessarily regrets about things that I did do.
Exactly. Well, when we did that Pugmire story recently, right? We said, both of us, why didn't I go up and say hi to him? I was just a little nervous at the time. I regret not doing it.
Yeah.
If I'd have walked up to him and he wasn't a cool guy, well, at least I'd know, you know?
Yeah.
I guess I feel like it's a lovely sentiment, but it's more or less impossible to pull off. You know, he says most people die of a sort of creeping common sense. And it's true, most people do, because it's more or less impossible to be that kind of carefree risk taker. I mean, I've never been able to access that sort of side of things. Although people who can and people who do are often very attractive individuals.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you didn't die of a creeping common sense, then that would probably mean that you died of doing something really stupid at a young age.
I mostly regret like conversations I had literally 20 years ago where I made a dumb joke and they didn't laugh. I mean, so I don't know how that fits into Henry's thing.
Yeah, that's true. There are certainly things I tried and do regret, and they are usually things like that.
But Lord Henry at this party, he's quite the raconteur, and he charms everyone, including Dorian.
It's more comedy stuff, one-liners and witticisms. I'll hit you with the SparkNotes synopsis of this chapter. It says, Lord Henry scandalizes the group by going on at length about the virtues of hedonism and selfishness and mocking his aunt's philanthropic efforts. I can sympathize with everything, he remarks at one point, except suffering. He insists that one's life should be spent appreciating beauty, seeking out pleasure, rather than searching for ways to alleviate pain and tragedy. Many of the guests are appalled by this selfishness, but he is so clever and witty that they are charmed in spite of themselves. Dorian Gray is particularly fascinated. And I do have to admit that that chapter works because sometimes he was winning me over.
Yeah.
Even though what he was saying is so against common ideas of what it is to be a moral person.
I guess what you can feel is you can feel the performance of it. And you can feel that kind of sense of being taken in. It's almost like, you know, if you watch a really good stand-up comedian and they can kind of really win you over with a premise, you know, caprice, you know, that can suddenly just seem like the most truthful thing in the world.
Yeah.
I think he's talking nonsense.
Yeah, I do too.
But because he's so persuasive with it and because he's so funny with it, it makes it seem true. And, you know, Oscar Wilde was a bit like Mark Twain over on the other side of the world in that he would do speaking tours and stuff, which were a kind of form of proto stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
That kind of rhetorical style, I think he helped shape. And so I think he's giving us a sort of taste of that here, that kind of idea of witty rhetoric that's kind of so drenched in irony that its intended audience kind of misses that and kind of takes it at face value.
Yeah, that's a problem with comedy in general. And I really liked this idea that is presented in the book that I think Lord Henry even says, one can't have conviction to really entertain an idea. So you can't really explore something unless you personally aren't invested in it. And so a lot of the things he says, yes, he doesn't live that way. But if he did live that way, it would influence what he's saying. You know, so in comedy, a lot of people take jokes as being instructive.
Mm.
You know, I'm trying to teach you how to live your life or something.
There is a contract that one makes between, you know, audience and speaker in such occasions like this. I think that's why it's so alarming, I think, when that contract feels broken. Like Louis C.K. done lots of material over the years that kind of touch on the kind of, you know, darker side of male sexuality and sort of obsession and stuff like that. And when it turns out that actually he has done stuff along these lines, it feels like it breaks that contract. It feels like, oh, we thought you were sort of talking to us from a position of understanding, that we were kind of drawn into this world, but actually you were kind of lying to us in a funny kind of way. What happens here is that Dorian takes it all far too seriously.
Yes, and so that's interesting. What's Lord Henry's responsibility to Dorian, who doesn't know the difference between a joke and whether that aphorism is actually speaking to real truth? I think is an interesting question. And something that I think culturally we're all wrestling with, what is the responsibility for what the artist puts forward? Even if it's fictive, is this promoting some values or things that we, you know, this is something that people are talking about every day. I also wondered at the beginning of this story if maybe Henry is the kind of person that takes pleasure in soiling clean things, if that's a motivation he has, the Lothario that just, you know, spoils virgins sort of thing. Like when I get a new dish sponge, there's a moment where you go, oh, the things I'm going to do to you. By the time I'm done, you are going to be wretched. And there's some weird, perverse pleasure in spoiling the unspoiled. But I actually, by the end of the book, I don't know if that's the case. I think he might just be careless and kind of oblivious. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It is fascinating that Wilde himself was kind of at the vanguard of the notion itself, as he talked about in his prologue, in his sort of author statement, that art is separate from the artist, that it's something else entirely. You know, you think about the Victorian novels of Dickens, they were all about social consciousness, and he's kind of wrecking that notion. I think what's fascinatingly brave about the book is that he twists it back on itself. He twists his own philosophy back on itself and questions it.
Yeah, totally. Now, but this gets us into chapter 4. It's a month after Dorian and Lord Henry have been hanging out. Dorian is at Lord Henry's place in Mayfair waiting for him to show. Dorian runs into Henry's wife, Victoria.
This story is so unkind to women, which I think we've mentioned, but it almost always describes them as stupid messes.
Yeah.
And I thought this description was perfect. She was a curious woman whose dresses always looked as if they had been designed in a rage and put on in a tempest.
Lord Henry, when he finally shows up, saying he was caught in some kind of business deal he couldn't get out of. And nowadays, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing, which is a Oscar Wilde quote I see thrown around all the time.
Yeah, he drops that one in there.
After his wife leaves, he tells Dorian, "Never marry at all, Dorian. Men marry because they are tired, women because they are curious. Both are disappointed."
And, you know, if criticism is a mode of autobiography, as he set up, then all of the awful things that Lord Henry is saying about everybody are really just things about him and his relationships.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting.
Dorian explains that he's in love with an actress named Sybil Vane. He discovered her when he was out wandering and he found this dodgy little theater. The theater is run by a Jewish fella, described in some pretty anti-Semitic terminology, who persuaded him to come into the theater.
Although one gets the sense that the characters in this novel are disgusted by anybody who's not rich.
Dorian claims that this is the greatest romance of his life. And Lord Henry says, "My dear boy, the people who love only once in their lives are really the shallow people. What they call their loyalty and their fidelity, I call either lethargy of custom or the lack of imagination. Faithfulness is to the emotional life what consistency is to the life of the intellect. Simply a confession of failure. Faithfulness."
He would have made a great advertising writer. Happy with what you have? You're an idiot. Kind of the notion.
So continuing with the story of how he met her, he explains it was a production of Romeo and Juliet. The production was terrible, but she was amazing. He's been to see her many times, and in many different roles, she's always been awesome.
He's so over the top about describing her performances. There's just no actor that's that good. You know, he could barely see her acting because his eyes are so glistening with tears. He can barely sit down there doing the play, and he's just like, "Oh! Oh! Oh! So powerful!" Weeping and gnashing.
So Henry wants to know if they're knocking boots, and Dorian, he gets all upset at that, and he goes, "Sybil Vane is sacred." And then Henry says to that, "It's only the sacred things that are worth touching."
I was like, was that written by an Oscar Wilde bot? It just recognizes the cadence of these things.
So he continues with the story. It says the manager tried to get him to go backstage to meet her, but he couldn't. So he's just been coming to her performances, seeing her in all these different roles. Finally, eventually, he gets the courage to meet up with her. He went backstage. She's also spent with him, and she calls him Prince Charming.
It's fascinating, I think, that the first object of Dorian's affection is the performance, you know, is the artifice of things, and quite how much he imprints on this woman's performances.
She doesn't even know his name. That's how artificial everything is, you know. They don't know. Yeah. They actually literally don't know each other.
So Henry seems a bit disappointed that it's also very chaste, and Dorian thinks Basil and Lord Henry should come see her because she's so marvelous.
And it always goes well when you introduce your new girlfriend to the boys.
I don't know if you've ever been in this situation. I had a friend of mine who was recently got dumped from a long-term relationship and had met someone else and wanted to talk to me about it and was kind of trying to get me to agree with him that this new girl who he'd been seeing for a couple of weeks was the true love of his life. And it's a very, very hard thing to not just say, "Dude, you're just love bombing hard. You need to chill."
Yeah. It just met. You don't know her.
It's kind of what's going on here.
Yeah. Well, Dorian is off to see another performance and he's full of joy and hope. Lord Henry coldly evaluates how things are going with Dorian and he thinks of him as some kind of experiment to analyze. And he wonders how Dorian's life is going to end, how it's going to play out. When he finally gets home late that night, there's a telegram from Dorian saying that he's engaged to be married.
Slow your roll, Dorian. The first few chapters of the book set up our characters, our premise. And I love that Dorian's first challenge is young love. It's not like he gets into a gambling scheme or something. It's just love. Because this seems like a natural bridge between the innocent world and the corrupted world, you know, for everybody.
Yeah.
That first love, first rejection, whether it's you that did it or them.
I think also the theater in those times was a form of mass entertainment. And I think, you know, lots of people now can kind of empathize with the fact that, like, say, watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer, if you're the right age when that show comes on, or The X-Files or whatever, you know, your fixations can be on these kind of starlets or these stars of screen and stuff like that. And that is often your kind of first romances, really, is you're these sort of imaginary romances you have with the people on the stage or screen. And I think, you know, this is very much the Victorian equivalent of that. And so it makes sense, I think, that Dorian's first challenge, his first love, is this kind of image of a sort of celebrity,
yeah,
rather than a real person.
Oh, that's so true, yeah.
So that gets us into chapter 5. We are in a dingy little home of Sybil Dane and her mother. Now, Sybil is totally smitten with Dorian Gray. Her mother is an actress herself and has been around the block and is trying to curb her daughter's enthusiasm. Sybil's father has seemingly passed away some time ago.
I felt like this whole chapter was such a melodrama and absent a lot of the wit of the other chapters, obviously because Lord Henry's not there, but I also feel like the unreality of the lower classes to these characters is kind of represented by the style in which this chapter is played. Like, they wouldn't have access to common lives except through melodramas where common people are depicted broadly and comically. So I felt like there was a perspective in this, too.
Oh, yeah.
That it struck me as odd. This was suddenly like, I felt like I was like a guy with a twirling mustache was going to show up and foreclose on the mortgage at any time. You know, it just had that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the revised sort of full length novel that was released after a sort of shorter version. This section was one of the bits that Oscar Wilde added.
Oh.
I think to kind of give some sort of social richness to the novel. But it doesn't particularly land, I don't think.
No, I mean, certainly it shows that there are real world impacts. This is kind of a sad scenario that he's setting up here. And there's some past that's touched on with the mother having been left by, you know, I think that the son's trying to figure that out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who was my father? And did he do the same thing Dorian's about to do to my sister? So,
well, yes,
it certainly shows what the damage is going to be by making these somewhat real people.
Well, like you said, we also meet Sybil's brother, James, who's off to Australia to try and make some money for the family. This is the first that James has heard about this gentleman suitor, Dorian, and he's worried for his sister. His mother tries to calm his fears, but he too has been around and he knows something that's too good to be true usually is. Plus, he knows his mother is vain and selfish. And there's a good line here. It says, children begin by loving their parents. As they grow older, they judge them. Sometimes they forgive them.
Sometimes they forgive them. You know, I think everybody goes through a period or never stops in their life when they catalog all the things their parents did that caused their current difficulties. And I imagine that you two as parents must lie awake some nights wondering, what will my kids blame me for?
There's plenty.
Yep.
When Sybil comes back, she sees James is worried about her and she takes him for a walk. She tries to calm him, but he discovers that she doesn't know his name and she calls him Prince Charming. James, he really doesn't want to leave now, but he's already signed up and that ship is leaving today. So he really has to go. When they get home, Sybil goes to her room and James wants to know if his mother and father were actually ever really married. And she confesses they weren't. He was also a gentleman who ditched them penniless. James says that if this suitor hurts his sister, he will come back and kill him. And I'm sure that's not going to pay off at all.
He's like, look, if Dorian ever wrongs you, I will kill him. But right now I'm leaving for a trip that takes about 10 chapters.
Also, the way that the brother and sister talk to each other, I have two sisters. And if I spoke to either of them in that way, that I think they would have me sectioned.
But that gets us into chapter 6. Basil and Henry are at a restaurant waiting for Dorian, and they use this opportunity to gossip about Dorian's engagement. Basil is worried, but Lord Henry has his usual tood. Basil calls him on his aloofness and says he acts like a jerk, but he's actually a good person. And I like what Lord Henry says here.
The reason we all like to think so well of others is that we are all afraid for ourselves. The basis of optimism is sheer terror. We think that we are generous because we credit our neighbor with the possession of those virtues that are likely to be a benefit to us. We praise the banker that we may overdraw our account and find good qualities in the highwayman in the hope that he may spare our pockets. I mean everything that I have said. I have the greatest contempt for optimism.
I think that might have been happening in that Lord of the Flies discussion we had recently, where it's like you want to see good in the world, so you were particularly attracted to an article that said, no, Lord of the Flies is crap. Everybody helped each other.
Yeah.
You're seeking confirmation of something that you hope is true.
I love it. It's such good writing.
So Dorian shows up happy as a clam. He tells them about how he proposed to her after a performance of As You Like It and how he kissed her and pledged his undying love for her. Basil, a hopeless romantic, really hopes that this is going to work out for them. Dorian says that Sybil undoes all the rotten ideas that Lord Henry has put into his head, and Henry takes it in stride and says this.
A cigarette is the perfect type of a perfect pleasure. It is exquisite, and it leaves one unsatisfied. What more can one want? Yes, Dorian, you will always be fond of me. I represent to you all the sins you have never had the courage to commit.
That is the best description of cigarettes.
It really is.
I mean, I gave up smoking, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And that line really makes me want to nip out and get 20 Lambert.
It does.
It sure does.
Stephen Fry, who is, you know, kind of played Oscar Wilde in a film and is kind of an advocate for Oscar Wilde in the modern day, I guess. Mm-hmm. He's fond of quoting this particular line. It's where I first heard it. And I think it's so unbelievably true.
It really is.
And is kind of an excellent explanation for cigarettes as an existential concept.
They all agree to go to the theater to see Sybil, but when they leave, Dorian and Lord Henry take a small carriage, forcing Basil to take another one behind them, which is the coldest of lunches. Chapter 7 comes at us with both barrels of anti-Semitic descriptions. We'll exclude it, but it's there.
One day I really hope to read a book written before like 1939 that doesn't include some monstrous Jew or something similar word.
Yeah.
The gang shows up in this dingy little theater and they're met by the manager, who happens to be Jewish. Dorian hates this guy, but Lord Henry raves about him, and we're not sure if he's making fun of this guy or not, but the theater is terrible and Dorian promises that Sybil's performance will make it all worthwhile.
I imagine Lord Henry's like that kind of person. You have somebody in your life who's very funny, but you're never sure, are they making fun of me?
Yeah,
you know. He's that guy. Yep. But I knew it was coming at this point because it just reminded me of, like, you know, when you do a play, maybe for the first time, you have so much fun, the audience loves it, somebody tapes it, you get a copy, and then you want to show it to a friend or a family member. And then you watch it, and it's suddenly you're just light-drenched blobs shouting at each other. It's not like you remember it, you know? You have to sit there and struggle through it. No, I could see how this was good.
A friend of mine says the magic words for when you go to see a friend's play, and it's awful. He used to go up to them afterwards and say, "You've done it again," which I have used.
That's a pretty good one. Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, that was something.
I had a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, that's a straight up lie.
And so when Sybil comes on stage, Henry and Basil are blown away by her beauty, but her acting is terrible. Dorian sees this as well. Something has changed in her, and he is freaked out about it. At the end of the show, Basil thinks that maybe Sybil is ill, but Dorian is really embarrassed, and he just wants them to go.
I love that Dorian Gray saw a bad play in a black box theater, and it ruined his life. So, you know, there are real consequences for seeing your friends. I love that in a classic work of literature, the incident that precipitates the main character's destruction is bad theater. That is amazing to me. I definitely, yeah, I'm going to use this to get out of some shows.
So Dorian goes backstage for an explanation. She's overjoyed to see Dorian and tells him that she's never going to act again. Dorian has shown her what real love is, and it pales in comparison to these plays. He's everything to her. Acting like you're in love is an affront to the real love that she now feels.
I love her attitude in this scene. You know, she comes back, he goes backstage to see her, and the first thing she does is say to him that she knows how terrible she was, which really, really makes me like her. You know,
yeah.
It's a love. It's kind of a kindness, if you're terrible, to say to someone, you know, sorry, I was so terrible. It's okay. But that's not enough for him.
Dorian is horrified, and then he says really horrible things to her.
You have killed my love. You used to stir my imagination. Now you don't even stir my curiosity. You simply produce no effect. You are shallow and stupid.
You are nothing to me now. I will never see you again. I will never think of you. I will never mention your name. What are you now? A third-rate actress with a pretty face.
Oh my God.
Oh,
absolutely amazing. And I think it's that kind of thing, like Oscar Wilde, by all accounts, a rather amiable and friendly kind of guy. But you know those guys that if you get on the wrong side of them and they suddenly turn their powers to evil, this is a slam and an act of violence, verbal violence like I've never heard. Amazing.
Obviously, she doesn't take this well. She begs and pleads with him, but he leaves her. He flees the theater and makes his way home.
I think this sequence where he walks out into the city, he leaves the theater and sort of wanders around. It's the first time in the book where we're really like aware of London as a landscape. Before this, we've all been very salon and restaurant based. And for me, it was where the novel really started clicking. And I was like, oh, I get you, Oscar. I see where we're at. Because you suddenly feel the sense of the city around us. And we're out of those salons and into a pretty up-to-date image of central London on a Saturday night. He says drunkards chattering to themselves like monstrous apes. And, you know, in Dickensian books and Victorian novels, we're always obsessed with describing the city. And this is the first time that Wilde does it. And I think it's basically giving us an image of this world that Dorian is now going to sort of descend into for the rest of the book.
Yeah, yeah. Very true. There's a similar moment in Jekyll and Hyde with Robert Louis Stevenson. It's also right around this middle point where we start to see the landscape of the city in a way that we didn't before.
The transitions have been invisible in this book. You know, the movement from one scene to another have been just like cuts in a film.
Yeah, no establishing shots.
And this is the first time he gives us that, yeah, like establishing shots of the transition from one place to another.
And when Dorian arrives home, he notices his portrait looks different. There is a touch of cruelty in the mouth, but he seems unchanged. He remembers the wish that he made at Basil's studio, and he thinks, could this be happening for real? And this makes him feel guilty about what he said to Sybil, and he realizes what he did was wrong, and he wants to make amends with her. He wants to marry her. He's sure his love will return in time. Note, he doesn't feel any love for her. He just wants to do right by her.
Yeah, and he's still going to sleep on it and get around to it tomorrow sometime, like any task that slowly falls down the to-do list, like paying a bill or mowing the lawn. I'll get to it.
I remember once I did karaoke, really like intense karaoke when I was at university. And when I got back to my digs, I wrote myself a note saying, don't worry about it, it was fine. Because I knew in the morning I was going to wake up and feel horrifyingly embarrassed by, you know, my performance the previous night.
Why would?
And of course, I woke up in the morning and read the note and I was like, nah, sod off. Last night, Jamie, you don't know anything.
I would say, why would you believe yourself?
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't believe a note from drunk me.
But you should have written back, and then maybe you could have started. That's very, you know, that's a good Twilight Zone start. You should have written back and said, sawed off, and then you get your past self writes back to you. What's going on?
In the morning, Dorian wakes up late. He has a nice breakfast, sees a letter from Henry, but he's not bothered about opening it. Dorian wonders if his mind played tricks on him with the painting, so he looks at it again, and yes, it is changed. It's all real, and he's freaked out by it. But he decides that this painting will be his moral guide. It will show him when he does wrong, and he could use it to do good. And at that point, he vows to marry Sybil, and he's going to do the right thing, and everything's going to be great.
Today's the day where I stop all of my bad habits at once.
And just then, Henry shows up, and he's a bit freaked out, which is something Lord Henry rarely is. He's there to make sure Dorian isn't too upset about the Sybil thing.
Yeah, we know that he's there to give some bad news. It's a little Three's Company man about the house farce here, you know, where Dorian thinks Henry's just talking about the breakup, but he's not.
Dorian says, no, it's all good. I'm going to marry her. And then Henry drops the bomb. Oh, no, she's dead.
Sorry, I had to do that because it's a hilarious misunderstanding.
I got to say, when reading this, it was sad. It made me feel bad.
He's sold you on the realness of it. You know, he's sold you on how far Dorian went with what he said to her. Yeah. And so you just believe it. There's no sort of element where you're going like, oh, maybe it's a hilarious case of mistaken identity. Yeah. It's like, no, I understand. I get it.
Dorian is grief-stricken. And Lord Henry, he says, don't worry. This scandal is not going to get to you.
I think he does reveal himself to be pretty callous in this scene.
Oh, yeah.
It's the part where you go, Basil keeps giving him the benefit of the doubt, maybe because he wants to see him as a positive person.
Yeah.
As described earlier. But the way that he reacts to this, no, he's a jerk.
Dorian is very upset, but Lord Henry says, let's go to the opera. Forget all this stuff. It would have been a terrible mistake if you did marry her, so it all worked out for the best.
It's like in the Big Lebowski where he's like, it, man, let's go bowling.
Totally. But, you know, Dorian's worried that he's heartless because he's not really crushed by this news. Lord Henry says, no, you're not heartless. And he says, well, I'm glad that you don't think I'm heartless. I'm nothing of the kind. I know I'm not. And yet I must admit that this thing that has happened does not affect me as it should. Seems to me to be simply like a wonderful ending to a wonderful play. It has all the terrible beauty of a Greek tragedy, a tragedy in which I took a great part, but by which I have not been wounded. Mm-hmm. And I thought this whole thing was interesting, the way that both of them are looking at life as a sort of... I mean, Lord Henry looks at life as a piece of art that he's criticizing, and he mm-hmm. likes that this happened because it has good story to it, right?
Yeah.
Although there's also something very realistic about this, where Dorian is expressing disassociation. You know, oftentimes when tragic, horrible things do happen, you think, why am I not crying? Sure. What's going on? You know, you actually experience that as well.
But then Henry, his take on it is pretty messed up.
It often happens that the real tragedies of life occur in such an inartistic manner that they hurt us by their crude violence, their absolute incoherence, their absurd want of meaning, their entire lack of style. They affect us just as vulgarity affects us. They give us an impression of sheer brute force, and we revolt against that. Sometimes, however, a tragedy that possesses artistic elements of beauty crosses our lives. If these elements of beauty are real, the whole thing simply appeals to our sense of dramatic effect. Suddenly, we find that we are no longer the actors, but the spectators of the play. Or rather, we are both. We watch ourselves, and the mere wonder of the spectacle enthralls us. In the present case, what is it that has really happened? Someone has killed herself for love of you. I wish that I had ever had such an experience. It would have made me in love with love for the rest of my life. The people who have adored me, there have not been very many, but there have been some, have always insisted on living on, long after I had ceased to care for them, or they to care for me. They have become stout and tedious, and when I meet them, they go in at once for reminiscences. Ugh, that awful memory of woman, what a fearful thing it is. What an utter intellectual stagnation it reveals. One should absorb the colour of life, but one should never remember its details. Details are always vulgar.
So quickly, Dorian is able to distance himself from her and see her as he saw her before, a character in a story, a tragedy like the plays he watched her in. So once Lord Henry leaves, he looks at the painting again and becomes interested in watching it change as long as he stays young and beautiful.
I really feel like this is where, for me, it's almost unconscious, but the story digs in the gut somewhere with this creeping horror. It's like right at this midpoint when, well, Dorian makes the decision to let this play out.
Mm-hmm.
For a moment, he thought of praying that the horrible sympathy that existed between him and the picture might cease. It had changed in answer to a prayer. Perhaps in answer to a prayer, it might remain unchanged. And yet, who that knew anything about life would surrender the chance of remaining always young? Besides, was it really under his control? Had it indeed been prayer that had produced the substitution? Might there not be some curious scientific reason for it all? If thought could exercise its influence upon a living organism, might not thought exercise an influence upon dead and inorganic things? Nay, without thought or conscious desire, might not things external to ourselves vibrate in unison with our moods and passions, atom calling to atom, in secret love or strange affinity? But the reason was of no importance. He would never again tempt by a prayer any terrible power. If the picture was to alter, it was to alter. That was all. Why inquire too closely into it? For there would be a real pleasure in watching it. He would be able to follow his mind into its secret places. This portrait would be to him the most magical of mirrors. As it had revealed to him his own body, so it would reveal to him his own soul. And when winter came upon it, he would still be standing where spring trembles on the verge of summer. When the blood crept from its face and left behind a pallid mask of chalk with leaden eyes, he would keep the glamour of boyhood. Not one blossom of his loveliness would ever fade. Not one pulse of his life would ever weaken. Like the gods of the Greeks, he would be strong and fleet and joyous. What did it matter what happened to the coloured image on the canvas? He would be safe. That was everything.
He stops to ponder the actual details of how this thing might be happening. It's a subtle change, it's a sudden bend towards realism. How does the painting change? Is it the atoms or, you know, I thought that was interesting. And then he goes, you know what, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to take advantage of it. And Dorian becomes the villain in this moment.
Yeah.
It reminds me of sort of later writers or the kind of H.G. Wells of this world who let you spend time enjoying the concept, to enjoying the sort of sci-fi fantasy concept a little bit, rather than just necessarily demarcating it as a bit of literature, as a little bit of a gothic caprice. Mm-hmm. They actually kind of like, let's think about this just for a moment. And I always enjoy it when writers do that.
Absolutely. You
know? One thing I really noticed when I was reading through this time is the sort of theme about the lack of responsibility that everyone is kind of disregarding. No one takes responsibility for their own actions in this story. Yeah. Mm. It reminded me of that Onion headline, which is wealthy teen nearly experiences consequences. Or, you know, maybe like a Bryce Ellis novel about a bunch of disaffected college kids meandering aimlessly into a violent nightmare.
Good call on that. Yeah.
At the end of Lesson Zero. Everyone is so quick to absolve themselves and everyone else from any sense of wrongdoing. And I think the book does a really good job of catching you up in that excitement, in the kind of delusion of that. Mm. But there's a sense of this kind of utter complicity in this world that's really pungent. Half a century later, the writer J.B. Priestley writes this play, Inspector Calls, which most kids in the UK do at school, where an entire Victorian family realise that they each have their own intertwined responsibility for the suicide of a young woman. And in the sort of big speech at the end, the inspector says, if men will not learn that lesson, they will be taught it in fire and blood and anguish. And Priestley had the benefit of hindsight to kind of suggest that the disintegration of the world that was coming through the wars was this kind of disintegration of empire and of this society. But I wonder if Oscar Wilde had a kind of sense of that, the sense that all these people privileged absolving themselves of the responsibility for the culture that they created, was kind of this hidden cost, this collective Victorian attic with portraits of themselves within.
Sure. Trying to analyze, why do I suddenly feel the sense of creeping horror when Dorian makes that active decision? I think it's because we are all Dorian Gray to the world to an extent. You use that plastic bottle and throw it away. It vanishes from your world. You don't have to see the ugly landfill. We feel indignation about things in the world that are terrible, while at the same time saying, when is somebody going to do something about that?
In the aphorisms that Wilde front loads the book with, and this kind of sense that, in the speech that Henry does earlier about, if you just followed all of your instincts and followed all of your desires, then the world would become this beautiful place. And whether that's true or not is one thing, but what Dorian does in this moment, the mistake he makes is he splits himself in two. He splits himself into the sin and into someone who has no sin, who has no soul, essentially. And that is his flaw. And you're right, that is all of our flaws, in that we think we can do both. We think we can absolve ourselves of sins while still committing them. Mm. And Dorian's mistake, Dorian's ultimate downfall is our mistake, is us all writing on Facebook about what an idiot Mark Zuckerberg is.
Right.
We all know. Right. If we stopped using Facebook, he would vanish from existence immediately.
Sure. So many things that we give our attention to complain about, we're empowering by giving the attention to it. And I think one reason we can get away with that, and social media is a perfect example, is because we know that the most important thing it's the externals. It's the things that people see. If people don't know about the sin, then you didn't commit it. If it's not on Instagram, it didn't happen, I've heard people say. Billy Crystal used to do a character, Fernando, who would say, it's better to look good than to feel good. Yeah. That's really driven home here, not just in the device of the portrait, but I think in how this relationship fell apart we just witnessed. It was all about externals. He liked the way that she made him feel. He liked the way that she was as an actress. When she became a real person that he couldn't show off to his friends, he didn't care for her anymore.
Yeah.
And I think everybody's keenly aware that what's really valuable about us, or we think or wonder or we're secretly scared that what's really valuable about us is how we look and how people perceive us, not who we actually are. And oftentimes we act in accordance with that rather than trying to be a good moral person.
Yeah.
Great book, man.
Touches on a lot of great stuff, but I think that is the point that we must stop, and we will return with the next part of this book, which is seeing everything kind of go to crap for Dorian Gray.
Yeah.
I want to thank Jamie Britton for coming on our show and rocking this book with us. I hope you're still up for rocking some more.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
My fainting couch has got a good few more faints. I don't even know what a fainting couch is.
I've got a few faints left in the chamber, son.
And I want to thank Greg Johnson for just bringing this stuff to life. He's got such a beautiful voice. It always does my heart good to hear him read. So thank you, Greg.
Man.
And again, check him out on YouTube, Greg, G-R-E-I-G Johnson. He's awesome.
I also want to I want to thank some patrons who've been along on this whole journey with us. I love them dearly. I'm going to start by thanking Daisy Fredericks.
I want to thank David Brown.
I'd like to thank Darren Wallace.
Pierce Duncan, thank you.
David Tibbetts, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Jason Zuliger.
I'd like to thank Jesse Greer.
Travis Shamp, thank you very much.
Sanjay Matthew, a gentleman and a scholar.
Hey, Sanjay.
Yeah.
And of course, I'd like to thank Bradley Perriman.
You all are so fantastic. We're going to be back with more Dorian Gray next week. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Jamie Britton.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.